Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Banana Bag Oral Solution. These are definitely not your typical dehydration supplement. In fact, they're my personal go-to after a long surf session when I'm looking to avoid exhaustion and dehydration. Check them out at bananabag.org and use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. You'll also get free shipping if you join their mailing list. Joining me today from the Central Valley of California is Dr. Kevin Dawson. Kevin's an associate professor of history at the University of California in Merced. As a fellow surfing historian, his research is situated at the historiographic crossroads of Atlantic history and the African diaspora, examining swimming, underwater diving, surfing, canoe making, canoeing, and fishing to consider how Atlantic Africans and members of the African diaspora used water as a cultural space. For today's episode, we'll be chatting about his intriguing surfing history of West Africa that he titled Undercurrents of Power, Aquatic Cultures in the African Diaspora. Undercurrents of Power centers around African traditions and the ways in which similar traditions, swimming, diving, boat making, and even surfing, emerged within African diasporic communities. This book not only chronicles the experiences of enslaved maritime workers, but also helps to trace and untangle many of their cultural and social traditions. This wonderful book, by the way, is featured on surfinghistorian.com. I'm super stoked to have you on to share all this incredible insight with our listeners. Kevin and I were on a panel together at a conference at San Diego State University, and I was immediately fascinated with his research on West African wave riders. So I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to him one-on-one about his research. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Kevin, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, Jason, it's great to be here with you. I'm glad you invited me on.
Yeah, of course, Kevin. You know, really stoked to have you on. And, you know, I just kind of want to get right into this. And, you know, you wrote the book, as I said in the intro, Undercurrents of Power. It won a Harriet Tubman Book Prize. And so really just kind of out of the gates, what compelled you to write this book? What's it about? And what is the Harriet Tubman Book Prize?
Yeah, so the Harriet Tubman Book Prize, it's for a prize. It's the best book in really considering the African diaspora. And so what the African diaspora is, it's basically looking at the movement of African people throughout the world and then the cultures they brought with them and how they recreated African cultures in the Americas primarily. And so the book is really considering how enslaved people, well, it's considering enslaved people's, like, their aquatic history in Africa. So swimming, underwater diving, and then since I'm here, definitely surfing. And so Africans have this rich, long history of surfing that they end up bringing them with them to the Americas, and you know, practicing it here.
Yeah, it's amazing. I really enjoyed the book. And, you know, just in that brief intro, you talking about the African diaspora and all that, like, there, I have so many questions, you know, but just really quickly, you know, I always call your book A Surfing History of West Africa. You know, what do you call it? And is that a fair thing to call this book? And I only ask that for the listeners, because, you know, I want to make sure I represent your book well, because, you know, not only do I recommend it, it's on surfinghistorian.com, but I want to know what you know, how you define it.
Yeah, so I see it. I do see it as a surfing history. I mean, I also see it as a history of other aquatics. So I think the thing for me is that when we look at it, when we look at African history, we might think of Africa as being this kind of dry place and Africans existing on land, but they did have this rich aquatic history where people, you know, lived along the coastline, along rivers. And so coastal peoples were definitely swimming, canoeing, fishing, surfing. And so surfing is, as the way I see it, is that it is central to the book because it allowed people to gain access to the sea. The knowledge of understanding how to navigate through waves was important for getting from land to sea for West Africans, because this is a region where there's not really natural harbors. And so the way to get there is, you know, if you're a fisherman, if you're a merchant, you have to get through the surf. And so they use surfing then as a means of pleasure, but then also as a way of, as I talk about in the book, surf canoeing. So basically designing these 30-foot long canoes, you have some examples of them in Endless Summer, and then catching waves as they're actually working, you know, to bring fishing nets ashore, to bring cargo ashore, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I do want to get into the Endless Summer, you know, their experience in Western Africa around some of these individuals. But, you know, as far as wave riding and this wave riding culture that you're talking about, of course, fishing and all that, how far back does this, you know, wave riding culture date in, say, Western Africa?
So it's hard to say. I mean, there are oral histories that suggest kind of when people might have started surfing or riding waves. I'm guessing at least 1,000 years. So it's probably not as old as in, like, say, Hawaii, but it definitely is at least 1,000 years. You know, when Europeans arrived in the 1400s, Africans were pretty well versed at surfing, at both surfing and surf canoeing, suggesting that it's several hundred years older than that.
Okay, yeah. And so I know, you know, we as surfing historians and surfers, and I'm certainly not going to put, you know, words in your mouth, but I always grew up learning about Hawaii, right? Like, that's the sort of cradle, if you will, the birthplace of sorts of surfing. Of course, your book has helped me see that that surfing or wave riding was going on in West Africa. And then, you know, others have written or talked about Peru as a place where people were, you know, wave riding. Why is so much attention focused on Hawaii? Or maybe a better question is why isn't there more talk of this, you know, seemingly robust wave riding culture in West Africa?
Yeah, so those are, I think, really great questions. I mean, first of all, I think Hawaii is, I mean, the birthplace of modern surfing, right? I mean, Hawaiians developed surfing far more than Africans did. I mean, they have a lot more kind of social, cultural, spiritual, political meanings wound into surfing, kind of enmeshed in surfing. And then also the techniques they're using. The surfboards seem more sophisticated than African surfing. But, you know, the thing is like, for Africa, the sources are actually there. I mean, they predate European surfing. I mean, they predate European accounts of Hawaiian surfing by more than 100 years. The problem is, I think, as historians, or as, you know, when we're trying to look at Hawaiian surfing, is that, you know, or African surfing rather, is that Europeans are arriving in Africa, and they see Africans, kids and kind of young men, because women typically weren't surfing, which we could talk about later. But you know, you have girls, boys, and then young men surfing. And so they see them surfing and they don't really know how to describe it. And so they give these kind of really bad accounts of surfing. They don't even understand how they're catching a wave. Like, they're at a loss because they'll say, like, okay, if we throw a piece of wood in the water, the wave will just break on the piece of wood, or it'll ride over it, but it won't actually propel it. And they don't understand that you had to match the wave speed to catch it. So they kind of fumble around with it, and then they're just kind of like, oh well. And then you also have a lot of images of Hawaii, of African surfing. So there's a lot of kind of late 1800s, early 20th century images of African surfboards and of African surfing, even postcards. Like, there's a lot of French postcards from the Ivory Coast of Cote d'Ivoire and Senegal of Africans surfing and surf canoeing. And we just kind of don't recognize it, that it's there. We just think of Hawaii as being the birthplace of surfing.
Yeah, no, and you bring up a very interesting point about the accounts of the Europeans trying to wrap their head around what, you know, what they're witnessing. And it's very similar to some of the early Westerners or Europeans in Hawaii writing about these, what they're looking at, what they're watching, and then trying to get in the water and, you know, and do that. But, you know, you bring up a really interesting point about the postcards. And then, as you said, some of the European accounts. And I would imagine finding resources to write about the history of surfing are more readily available or more accessible for, say, Hawaii. How did you go about finding these stories? I know, I feel like you and I have talked about this before, and you might have said something to the effect of they were hiding in plain sight. And so, as a historian, as a researcher, how were you able to find these stories and tell this story?
Well, I think one of the things is, like, you know, as historians, we typically have like kind of a small geographic focus and a small time period. Because I was looking, I didn't start off looking at surfing. I started off looking at like kind of aquatics more broadly, like so the swimming, canoeing, fishing kind of stuff. And so I was looking at accounts from like the 15, 1600s. And I knew that Africans learned to swim at a really early age. And then there's these accounts written by some German and French guys and Dutch guys. And they're basically like, yeah, these parents, they're taking, so the early accounts say Africans were learning, mothers were teaching their kids to swim at like 3-4 months old. But then I find these accounts and they're talking about, well, they're teaching kids to swim by like putting them on boards when they're 5 or 6 years old and pushing them out into the surf. And I'm like, well, if they already learned how to surf or how to swim, why are they teaching them again, you know, several years later? And so I didn't really know what to do with those accounts. And I didn't even know what those were for a couple of years. And then I actually found accounts from the 1800s that actually sound almost identical to the accounts that are written by like Mark Twain and Jack London, who describe surfing in Hawaii, or like Herman Melville. And I was like, oh, okay. So Africans were surfing, and these earlier accounts written, you know, in the 15, 1600s are actually documenting that process. And so that then allowed me to kind of draw out a map and to begin to go farther and farther back in time and look for kind of what's going on there and why Africans were surfing. Because one of the things too that I realized is that, like, having gone to Africa and spent a good bit of time there, especially in the 90s, is that like kids would surf, and then when they got to be about 15, 16 years old, they'd stop. And like, I could never really get a straight answer on why they stopped surfing. And it was like, well, that's just a kid's activity. And I'm like, okay, well, I mean, it's a kid's activity for us, or like playing soccer or basketball. It's kind of a, you know, a kid's activity, but adults still enjoy it. And so then what I realized was that, like, it was a way for them to understand how to ride waves so that they could then ride or use these surf canoes, which are still used today.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, that notion that, oh, you know, surf, oh, that's just what, you know, the kids are doing. And, but you know, the way you make it sound is it really, certainly, you know, the kids were engaged in surfing or wave riding, but it was a training ground of sorts for, you know, later navigating these waves and using these, you know, you said, fishing canoes. And that, so that brings me to a question I had, and I know you and I talked about this before, but regarding those fishing canoes, and they make an appearance in the Endless Summer movie, the original one of the 1960s. Would you mind maybe, you know, elaborating a little bit or explaining what we as, you know, individuals just watching that movie and seeing these different scenes and interactions between, you know, the main characters and the people they encounter here on these coastlines, what are we seeing, right? Can you help us understand like these interactions? Because I always kind of looked at it as like, oh, well, they're, you know, it felt very colonialist in a sense, but can you explain, you know, what we're looking at in those scenes?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I've watched it many, many times to try and understand like kind of all the nuances and complexities. So what you can see from that is actually a lot. So one thing you can see is you can see how surf culture spread. So the surf culture that's there, what you have is people at Accra, which is the capital of Ghana, and they're ethnically Ga, which is spelled G-A. Now, you can tell, though, that, and we know from historical sources, that the Fanti, who are another ethnic group about 100 miles away from Cape Coast Elmina area, they end up introducing surf canoeing to the Ga. And one of the ways you can tell it is by the paddle they use, that trident-shaped paddle that they say looks like a spork or something in Endless Summer. That's an actual Fanti designed paddle. And so, yeah, so they've introduced it, and we know from historical sources that the Fanti introduced surfing and surf canoeing to the Ga in the mid 1700s. And so they had been surfing by the time, you know, Bruce Brown and the Californians show up for a couple hundred years. And so what we can also tell is that, I mean, it's somewhat staged. I mean, I think that the surfers show up there, they're surfing, and then they see these Ga fishermen go out and they're blown away by it. And then they have them like kind of go out and give another demonstration or a couple demonstrations, because you can see at least two, maybe three different surf canoes. And then one of the times they're going out to not even catch fish. And so that definitely is just like them giving a demonstration. Another thing, though, I think that you can see is that although Brown is claiming that the Californians have introduced surfing, you can get an example here, as we talked about, where the boys or the men, the young men, had actually known how to surf. They hadn't surfed for a couple of years. So when Brown shows up, they're still able to surf, but they're a little bit shaky. So at one point, there's these two guys who look like they're probably, you know, 18 to 22, and they borrow Robert August and Heinz Surfboards, and they stand up, and the very first wave that one of the guys paddles for, he catches and he stands up, and Bruce Brown is like blown away. He's like, I can't believe this guy actually caught a wave and stood up. It's the first time he's ever seen that. And it's like, no, this isn't the guy's first wave. He's a little bit shaky because he hasn't surfed in a few years, but you can definitely, we know now looking back that he had been able to surf, or that he had probably grown up surfing, and that's why he's able to catch a wave so easily and stand up, you know, on his quote unquote first wave.
Yeah. Now, you know, I was going to ask you about that scene as well. And I'm glad you mentioned that. And, you know, maybe some of the listeners are like, wow, man, I got to go back and watch Endless Summer again. But yeah, you know, thank you for sort of explaining that, because, you know, when you watch the movie, you do get this sense where it's like, wow, that guy's a fast learner, but that's not necessarily the case. The case is that he was probably, when he was a bit younger, as you said, this was something he was doing quite often. So it was just, you know, he just jumped on the board and it was natural because it's something he'd already been doing. So yeah, that's.
And if you slow down that scene, or if you watch, if listeners watch that scene again in Ghana, and they don't look at the Americans, but they look at the Ga kids, you can actually see like five or six traditional Ga boards in the background. And so at one point, Bruce Brown is like, yeah, the kids, they see these Americans surfing and they run home and get boards and they all start surfing. No, I mean, they have a nose on them. They're clearly shaped for wave riding. I mean, they're equivalent now of kind of like a bodyboard or a boogie board, but they clearly are riding waves or boards designed to catch waves.
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm going to have to go back and watch that again. I know when you and I talked about it originally, or when you were talking about it, when you know, we were in San Diego, it was pretty fascinating. It's just something I didn't know. You mentioned the paddle or the trident, I think you called it. What is that? Why was that so popular, or what purpose did it serve? Why not have a fully rounded out, paddle essentially?
Yeah. So that shape paddle, I mean, so Fanti had a kind of a more traditional shape paddle, like what we might think of, or, you know, what you might get if something that would look similar to if we went to a store and got like a canoe paddle here in the US or someplace. But these, you can pretty much tell a surf canoe paddle from a paddle that would be used on a river, because it has a very distinctive shape. So it has to be able to create a lot of thrust. So it has to have a lot of surface area. But then also, if you imagine, if you're paddling in waves, there's all this chop. And so when you're bringing the paddle forward, you want to be able to reduce the amount of friction, or if it strikes a wave. And so by having these kind of three fingers, slightly spread fingers, they actually, when you pull the paddle quickly through the wave, it creates a large surface area where water will not pass through those fingers. And so it'll create a lot of thrust when you're paddling it. And then on the forward stroke, when you're bringing it forward more slowly, it doesn't create as much resistance if it hits like chop or something like that. Some of the other paddles will be like really long and narrow and then widen out near the handle. But then this one with the three fingers is a really popular one, because it also lets you get down low in the water and really use like your core to paddle and get a lot of energy into that paddle stroke.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I guess, you know, I'm sort of asking you in this statement I'm making, but, you know, it seems that further substantiates this intimate relationship that these individuals had cultivated with the ocean. You know, they really knew the waves. They really knew how to navigate these beach breaks and essentially ride them, as you said, on these canoes. I want to talk a little bit about sort of moving away from the actual African coastline and a little bit more about the diaspora. And again, just for some of the listeners who are unaware, like what, when we talk about an African diaspora, what are we, and I know you mentioned that briefly at the beginning, but what are we talking about?
So with the African diaspora, we're talking about like the movement of a people and their culture. So, you know, along like 50, 60 years ago, really until the 1970s or 80s, historians assumed that, you know, the slave trade and slavery were so brutal that enslaved people lost kind of their ability to retain cultural practices, that they focused more on like just merely surviving those traumatic experiences. But what historians have realized is that recreating, kind of reimagining African cultural practices was part of this survival process. And that if we look at Africa, African cultural practices, and the cultural practice of enslaved people, and then also African descended people, and then also of Americans today, we can see a lot of African cultural practices that we didn't realize. And so these enslaved people, they're not just recreating kind of small aspects of their cultural practices, but, you know, everything about it. So, you know, they're diving into the water to catch fish. They're taking those fish home. They're cooking them in African style, like they're making African meals, you know, gumbo, pepper pot, jambalaya. You know, Northerners who go down to the South, or Europeans who go to the South, or enslaved, or, you know, slave owners, they smell this food cooking and they're like, oh, that smells really good. And they try it and it becomes part of like kind of American cuisine, American culture. And so it's really looking deeply at like kind of all of the cultural practices that enslaved people are able to recreate. They're not always able to recreate them perfectly. And so in some instances, they're having to reimagine them, right? And so that's also what it's about. So like if you have to have a substitute for something, you know, in Africa, a lot of canoes were made out of silk cottonwood trees. In the Americas, you know, if you're in the Caribbean, you could come across a silk cottonwood, but if you're in North America, probably not. So what do you use? A bald cypress, a pine tree. So finding these substitutes.
Yeah, that makes, you know, a lot of sense. And you know, I again, personally, I appreciate that explanation. You know, you mentioned a lot of the examples you gave of, you know, some of the things that came as a result of the diaspora. You mentioned food, you mentioned gumbo, and I think jambalaya and a few things like that. Other than food, what are some of the other practices? And this could be, you know, and say what is now the United States or the broader Atlantic world, which I know you work with. What are some of the other practices that we see that have come from this diaspora?
Yeah, so another really good example is rice, the cultivation of rice. So I ask my students a lot of times, you know, just to kind of unsettle their assumptions of the past, what was the wealthiest colony and state in America up to the Civil War? And they're always going to look to like the North, you know, New York, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, maybe Virginia, but it's actually South Carolina. South Carolina was the wealthiest colony and wealthiest state up to the Civil War. And the thing that made South Carolina so wealthy was the production of rice. And so the rice growing technique, you know, you have to imagine the white colonists were from England. They weren't growing rice in England. And so they did see indigenous people cultivating rice and they tried to do it because rice was considered exotic in the 1700s. And it could be sold for a lot in Europe, but they weren't really able to domesticate it. And so what they actually found were enslaved Africans growing rice during their free time. And so they ended up learning how to grow rice from enslaved Africans from the Senegambia, from what's now Senegal, the Gambia, you know, down into Sierra Leone. And so these Africans introduced this rice growing technique. They're able to exchange this technique for benefits, you know, to make their lives more pleasurable, basically for time off. And so they get something out of this kind of exchange, and it ends up changing really, you know, American economy. You know, it introduces rice to Americans, not just introducing rice, but like, you know, there's a reason why we, and I'm not trying to be like flippant here, but why we don't eat sticky rice and we don't use chopsticks, but we eat rice with a spoon. Because Africans, they parboiled the rice. So they'd take it and they'd parboil it or convert it, partially cook it, which makes each grain of rice distinct. And then they ate it with a spoon. And they introduced that then to white Americans.
Wow. Yeah. And you know, being from the South, I always, and I know you've spent time in South Carolina yourself, but being from, you know, Virginia, North Carolina area, you know, I was unaware of that. And, you know, I like that you clarified why we eat rice with a spoon too. Cause you know, I always, you know, that was something I'm like, well, all the places when I think of rice, you know, say like eating sushi or what, you know, whatever, just with chopsticks. So yeah, I had no idea about that. You know, one of the things that as somebody who studies Latin America, you know, something that came about as a result of the diaspora has, you know, is the dances and music. And, you know, when we think of salsa, merengue, a lot of the, you know, the circum-Caribbean music is very much infused with African movements and sounds. Would you mind speaking to that as well?
Yeah. I mean, so you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the music, the cultural practices, you know, scholars are definitely drawing direct links to particular places. So like say Cuba and Senegal, and with, you know, and it's not just a one-way process, right? I mean, so Africans introduce, you know, different music traditions into Cuba, for example. You have the development then of salsa, and then that's re-exported to Africa, and it's not as popular anymore, but there's what was known as African salsa, which is really great dance music coming out of like primarily Senegal. And so this music is definitely going both ways. Styles related to music is also, and dancing, I mean, a lot of the dances are definitely African influenced. Related though is that also African forms of martial arts, primarily what we now know as capoeira, which comes out of the Congo. And so that's actually like a spiritual type of performative martial arts that was oftentimes hidden in dance in Brazil, because enslavers didn't want, for good reason, their enslaved people to know how to fight. And so enslaved people were hiding it. So they're playing music, dancing, but still doing those martial arts moves as a way of kind of training. And so you definitely see this mixture then of not only dance and music, but then also martial arts in Brazil, but then also there's examples of it also in Cuba, and then also in South Carolina. So you get this kind of all over the place.
Yeah. And of course we could, you know, get into the religion, you know, Santeria and among a number of other, you know, religious practices throughout the Atlantic world. And, you know, I want to stay on the topic of surfing the best I can, because there's so much, you know, to talk about with the African diaspora, including many of the slave rebellions, how interconnected those were, and their, you know, how they took in from inspiration from, say, the Haitian Revolution, later the Aponte Revolution in Cuba of 1812, Nat Turner, all of these, you know, there's such an intriguing connection and almost like web of communication among these groups throughout the Atlantic world. But maybe you can answer this question, because it's, you know, as you were talking, I was curious, because we talk about, you know, the history in West Africa of wave riding and interacting with the ocean in a way that, you know, we might almost define as, say, surfing. As in this diaspora, are there any places where this similar interactions with the ocean started to manifest with these throughout the diaspora of in the Atlantic?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
World,
yeah. I mean, so you definitely see enslaved Africans maintaining the kind of their links with the ocean, right? I mean, so they might have to work all day in sugar fields or rice fields, but they're going to rivers and the ocean at the end of the day to like kind of cool off, to relax, to swim around, you know, to enjoy their bodies, to enjoy time with their community members. And so they're definitely maintaining those connections. They're swimming in their free time to catch sea turtles, to harvest shellfish, you know, to augment the rations that their enslavers are giving them. They're doing all those, maintaining all those kinds of connections. So as far as surfing goes, it's a little bit harder to document surfing in the Americas. Like there's these accounts that are, I mean, there's an account in South Carolina, for example, where this Englishman comes across these Africans on the beach and they seem like they're surfing, and he starts talking about that. And then he's like, he gets distracted by a sea turtle and he's like, oh, wait, no, there's a sea turtle here. And, you know, we can get all these sea turtle eggs, which were considered a delicacy. So we do see some of those. We do see some examples in Southern Jamaica where, again, this guy, this Englishman is going around and he comes across this group of like 12 or so Africans, and they seem to be, well, they're in the water. They seem to maybe be surfing. And then he starts talking about them fishing. And it's like, just, can you finish what you, so we don't always have like these kind of rich descriptions of surfing that we would like, or that I would like. But what I think we do have that documents surfing, or wave riding, or however we want to define it, is that, believe it or not, Africans using, enslaved Africans in the Americas using surfboards to gain their freedom. So we see them getting on surfboards and paddling between Caribbean islands. So between now what was the Danish West Indies and what's now the U.S. Virgin Islands and the British Virgin Islands, people actually paddling between there, or escaping from the British Virgin Islands, or the British West Indies, which is now the British Virgin Islands, to say Puerto Rico, like going significant distances on these kind of surfboards / paddleboards that are upwards of like 20, 30 miles across the ocean, crossing between Jamaica and Cuba, which is almost 100 miles, and doing that in dugout canoes, and then also on these paddleboards, or between the islands off the coast of South America. You know, making these, or these distances crossing between Florida and the Bahamas, right between the U.S. and British colonies, especially after Britain abolished slavery in like 1834, 1836. So you definitely see these accounts, which suggest that there is, that Africans, enslaved Africans, were surfing. They're just not, I mean, we see them, the accounts of them in the ocean swimming with paddleboards and with boards, but they're often at times not saying like that they're surfing. We do also see accounts, I should say, of Africans riding waves, of enslaved Africans riding waves in canoes. So I've seen a number of accounts in Jamaica, in South Carolina, and Brazil, of enslaved Africans catching waves in canoes and riding those ashore. Also in Trinidad.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, having lived in Roatan in Honduras, which was part of the, you know, the Bay Islands of Honduras, and being around a lot of really good friends who were Garifuna, you know, as you're talking about, you know, these enslaved Africans getting on canoes, or, you know, what we would call paddle boards, or, you know, these crafts, it's just reminding me of some of the stories that they share with me of, you know, ancestors fleeing. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, well, yeah, they probably did exactly what you're talking about. And again, the Garifuna are very much an example of what we've been talking about. You know, these, it's, you know, you go to a Garifuna party and the music is very, very clearly African. The dances are very clearly African. The way they play some of their instruments using conch shells and things like that. And so, yeah, it's, you know, as you're talking, it's, you know, a lot of those experiences I had living in Roatan, I didn't have a really profound understanding of all that history. And as you're talking, it's sort of putting some pieces together. And so, you know, I, like I said, I personally appreciate it. You say something in your book, you know, that I wanted to ask you about that sort of is along these lines, actually. You said colonists did not culturally conquer water. And then you go on to say that this allowed captives to impose African meanings upon waters that were once known only to Amerindians, using them to maintain distance, distinctiveness, and some sense of ownership over their lives. What did you mean by that? Does that kind of fit with what we've just been talking about?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean it ties into your previous question too about like all these rebellions and like the kind of the communication that's going on and stuff like that. And so like as surfers, right, how do we find out about good waves, you know, good breaks? I mean, at least before the internet. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you'd be talking to somebody. I mean, it's always you're talking to somebody. I mean, still, even with the internet, you know, I'll meet people at a beach and they'll be like, you know, telling me about some break, you know, a little bit of it that's it close by or far away. And so one of the things I think to understand is that enslaved Africans, many of them were working on the water. So we think oftentimes of slavery as being plantations, right? The production of cotton, of sugar, tobacco. And it was, I mean, most people were doing that. But you also had to get those things to market. You had to get those to ports. So they're oftentimes being loaded, like the waters of the Americas are very similar to the waters of Africa, where you have this kind of shallow water, you have surf. And so in many ways, it was easier to bring slave-produced commodities to market in dugout canoes, African-style dugout canoes. So many enslavers instructed their captives to build these African-style dugout canoes. They'd load these commodities, and they'd begin shipping them, you know, 20, 30 miles to a seaport or between islands in the Caribbean. And so they're moving around. And then, you know, you have examples where enslaved people, they might be stuck in, say, Rhode Island, and they're tired of the Rhode Island winter. And so they go to the Caribbean for the summer, or for the winter, excuse me. And then they go back home. Or they might be enslaved on an island in the Caribbean, and they are sick of it. And, you know, they think their owner's not treating them well, and they escape to another island. And sometimes, believe it or not, they actually would write letters back home. So you have examples of people writing letters back to their enslavers, kind of as a stick in the eye, like, haha, I escaped and I'm here. We also have examples of them writing letters back to former community members, enslaved community members. So we have this circulation of information that helps people plan rebellions, that help people escape, and that help people retain these connections with the ocean. I mean, one of the other things too, I think that's important to understand is that, like in the Western context, the ocean is this place of kind of damnation, right? It's often in the Bible, you know, it's used as a flood to punish people for sins and things like that. But for Africans, the ocean was the realm of the dead. So when one died, their soul went to the bottom of the ocean or across the ocean, depending on what ethnic group they were in, and the soul would wait there to be reborn. And so people escaping, like we have accounts, as we talked about already, of people escaping, and they're known as maritime maroons, who escape across water, either swimming, you know, taking these kind of surfboards, paddleboards, canoes. But if they didn't make it and they die in the process, for them, for those people, the sources suggest that they still succeeded because they end up dying and then they're going to be reborn in the communities they were stolen from. So in death, they'd be reborn in their African homelands. And so I know that's kind of all over the place, but like you get, you know, these people moving around in different ways, spreading information, maintaining these ties to the ocean, and maintaining their aquatic practices.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you, you know, as you're talking, there was a number of books that are coming to mind that, you know, as someone who studies Latin America and the Atlantic world, you know, there's The Common Wind, which is a great book. Freedom's Mirror, actually, which kind of looks at the wake of the events of the Haitian Revolution, and how that impacted Cuba and its sort of early 19th century, you know, impetus behind the start of what eventually becomes, you know, a series of different revolutions there. And so, yeah, there was this, you know, in reading these books and hearing you talk, you know, there's this real web, if you will. And a lot of it sounds like the communication or even people escaping was in many ways by way of, you know, surf paddling, essentially. And yeah, you know, you as you were talking as well, this is something I pulled from your book, and I can't remember if it was about specifically West Africa or you might have been talking about Hawaii too, but either way, it really embodies what you were saying about Westerners' view of the ocean versus, you know, many of these people who grew up around these ocean environments. And it says Western apprehensions of water and other people's affinity for, and I love this line, gliding through liquid infinities. And then it's a quote, these people find one of their chief amusements in that which to us, and this was, of course, a diary issue or something, which to us presented nothing but horror and destruction. And so right there, you see this, you know, these individuals observing people playing in the ocean and enjoying themselves, whereas these Westerners, these Europeans are, as you said, they see it with fear and trepidation. And so I don't know if I got that right, but is that about West Africa or Hawaii? I can't remember.
So that's actually Hawaii. And so that one I think is really telling, because that's written by this doctor on James Cook's voyages. And so he is describing what some historians would say is the first description of surfing. And I think that's really telling because, like, look, these guys had just spent, I think, 6 or 7 months on a ship and had barely gotten wet, right? I mean, they cross the entire Atlantic. They cross the Pacific. I mean, they go around South America. I mean, this is a long voyage to reach Hawaii. And yeah, they see these kids, these grown men, see these kids playing in the ocean, and they're terrified of the ocean. They're terrified of waves. And the same thing plays out in Africa. Like, you see time and time again, Europeans and Americans, and they're like, man, it is so hot here. And they're looking at Africans swimming and having fun in the ocean and saying, you know, I wish I could swim because I'd love to get out there and cool off in the ocean. They'd actually ride the surf canoes. So Africans would put a chair on the front, like screw a chair down to the front of a surf canoe so that Europeans could sit there and enjoy that kind of thrill. So it's not definitely like wave riding, you know, getting yourself wet and getting in there, but they could still enjoy it that way. And so they definitely, I mean, they're afraid of the ocean in West, or the surf, right? That surf zone in West Africa. They also saw it like they were just terrified that if they fell overboard, you know, they drown, because most white people at the time weren't strong swimmers. And then they were terrified also of the sharks. I mean, they felt that if they fell over, the instant they, you know, kind of parted the water, they'd be eaten. And so they oftentimes called Africa like a surf-bound coast, just because they saw these waves as this kind of barrier, kind of intellectually as well as physically, that prevented them from getting in the water and enjoying their bodies in the surf. Unlike, you know, white people would do, Westerners in Hawaii in kind of the second half of the 1800s.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I was, when I was driving yesterday, I was listening to Matt Warshaw's I was listening to it on Audible again, The History of Surfing. And, you know, he, in some of the early chapters, talks about those experiences in Hawaii. And, you know, as I was listening, and, you know, of course, as after listening to, you know, what you were just saying, just imagining that trek from, you know, say Europe down and around South America, and then eventually over into Hawaii, you know, that's a long haul for sure. But Kevin, yeah, this has been an absolute pleasure, and it's just super stoked to have you on. But before we finish, I just wanted to make sure there wasn't anything that, you know, I might have overlooked in your book, or there was maybe something else you wanted to talk about. But in any case, with that, I'm gonna go ahead and give you the last word.
Oh, no, I mean, this has been great. I love it. I mean, it was a great opportunity to sit here and riff with you about surfing, surf history. And I would just say to the readers, or to the listeners rather, I would actually argue, I mean, the kind of the one elaboration I would argue or say is that Hawaiians definitely perfected surfing, and other Polynesian peoples were definitely surfing. But I think as we look around the world, we're going to find that other people were surfing or riding waves, however we might categorize it, in these kind of tropical regions. So I think as we look, and not even tropical, I mean, Peru is pretty cold water, is my understanding, and they were riding waves. We'd probably find that indigenous Californians were riding waves, and you know, peoples in the Caribbean, and probably peoples in the Indian Ocean. You know, they were probably, we'll probably find accounts of like Sri Lankans wave riding at some sort at some point. We just need to keep an open mind as far as what the sources are telling us.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Kevin about his research on the history of West African surfers, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by American Studies and Feminist Studies scholar, Dr. Krista Comer. She and I will be discussing, among other topics, her book, Surfer Girls in the New World Order, published in 2010, as well as her forthcoming book, Living West as Feminist, Conversations about the Where of Us. If these topics pique your interest, then this will certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Banana Bag Oral Solution again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at bananabag.org. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. Be sure to join their mailing list too if you want free shipping. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.